Thank you, Brother Tom. As you can see on the screen, the topic that Brother Len Grice has for us is a view of Israel's conflicts, past, present, and future. And the last 15 minutes of the discourse are going to be open for a question and answer session. So if you have any questions, write them down, and you can ask them at the end. So a view of Israel's conflicts, past, present, and future, Brother Len.
Brethren, I'm very happy to be here with Rachel. I want to bring love to you from your brethren in Delaware Valley. You know many of them, and they would be here if they could. Here we are doing one of our favorite activities, not eating, meeting together and then eating. But they did want to send special love to you, and also love from the rest of our family. Rachel and I are here, but Gretchen is visiting her brother in England during the month of May, as she usually does, but she wanted special love, sent me an email this morning, said, give my love to the brethren, and her son Aaron, who's home minding all the animals and the houses, but they wanted love sent too. I also wanted to tell you, anyone know what city this is?
Baia Mare,
yes, very good. I want to remind you, there is a convention, an international convention next year. That convention will be in Baia Mare, Romania. So if you haven't been to an international convention before and you think you might want to go and you haven't been to Romania, here's your opportunity to do both. It's a very lovely place, and I have some newsletters with me. If you'd like, please just stop by and I'll give you one. We just want you to start thinking about that. The dates are August 8th through the 13th next year. Well, I think one of the safe things to talk about is Israel, because there's a lot of opinions, but there's also a lot of news. And to me, one of the greatest evidences we have, greatest evidence, if not the greatest, that the Lord's hand is here working in this earth is the nation of Israel. And I want to look at three things, and the past, the present, and the future. And of course, the present is very interesting, but the past is prologue, as we know, and that's what's important. And the future, I'm going to touch just briefly on the future because that's fit with perils and just want to make some observations. But the important thing that I hope we take away from this is to see the trends that we see going on and identifying those. And safe thing is, if you heard this talk, maybe you were in Columbus where we talked about some of this, things have totally changed, and that's the good thing. As far as the current things. But I think it behooves us to at least look at this, because Israel is such a piece of God's time clock, and we should be thankful that we have that. And you know, we are advocates of Israel and Israel's place in the kingdom, and there aren't a lot of people out there that are, and especially today, they're being severely, severely persecuted and thought about in ways we don't want. You know, President Obama, it was interesting, you know, he just made a trip and visited with Netanyahu in Israel, and he was called a liar by the Hamas. Now, he's been a pretty liberal person as far as it relates to Israel and as far as it relates to the Palestinian state. But, you know, I think people expected something much greater of what happened in his May 18th meeting in Israel than what happened. And so it's interesting, here's Hamas calls him a liar, and even though he's supporting a two-state solution. Now, the interesting to watch with Obama, who has been a supporter, at least a supporter of Israel as a democracy, is going to be in Egypt, in Cairo, June 4th. It's the first time I meet there, but it said June 4th is when he's laying out his Middle East plan. You know, it's interesting. Every president comes along and lays out their Middle East plan. Well, I hope to lay out God's Middle East plan here. And I don't know which one you want to believe, but for me, I'll take God's. You know, the Iranian chief of staff, General Hassan Firouzabadi, on May 4th, made this statement. He said, it will take 11 days to wipe Israel out of existence. Anybody have some advice for General Hassan? I I think it's clear, one of the things that's clear, is that the Islamic neighbors surrounding Israel will never recognize them. You know, that's as far as we go. Every time Israel says, recognize us, we'll give you a chance, that's all it would take. You know, and yet they can't get to that point. Hamas met on Tuesday, May 19th, after Obama's meeting with Netanyahu, and they issued a statement. The statement said, Obama's remarks and expressions of hope were intended to deceive the international community regarding everything connected to the continuing behavior and existence of the racist and radical Zionist entity. Now, there's every year, or at least periodically, there's a poll taken or a survey taken in Israel of the Arab population of Israel. As you know, if you've been to Israel, you know there's a distinct Arab population and there's a distinct Israeli, about 1 million Arabs that live there. In the past, about 28% of them have been supporters of Israel, or about 28% have been deniers of the Holocaust of Israel. You know what that number's up to now in the most recent survey? 40%. I heard that. That had to be Bob Gray. Oh, John. Very good. Well, it could have been Bob Gray. Or it could have been any of you. 40% now deny the Holocaust. You know, it's like if you tell, and Hitler discovered that, didn't he? Hitler discovered that if you tell an untruth long enough, it becomes in people's mind a truth. For most of the Islamic world, peace with Israel means the peace of the grave. That's the way they look at it. Well, if we look at how big a threat the Jews in the world really are, you'd say, wow, it got to be overwhelming everything. But realistically, if you took a room like this, now maybe we could get 453 people in this room, and you had a cross-section of the world population, you said 453 people, and I want a cross-section of the world population, how many of those are Jewish?
One.
You're right, one. 453 to 1 are pretty good odds. But remember, that one has God on their side. And that's what people don't realize. There's two simple truths about the situation in the Middle East. If nothing else, remember these two things. As you look at Israel today, if the surrounding nations put down their weapons today, there wouldn't be any more violence. But the second unfortunate truth is, if the Jewish nation put down their weapons today, there would be no more Israel. That's the reality we face, brethren. So despite what we think happens in the future, and we know the prophetic pictures that are there, today Israel has to fight for their existence. And it shouldn't surprise us. It's been true throughout their history. God told them to fight, and they had to fight for their existence. So it's no different today. Now, we know at some point in the future, God intervenes, and we'll get to that towards the end. But let's spend a little time on Israel and the Middle East. Here it is in the Middle East, 23 countries in this Middle East area. And you could argue whether some of these are truly Middle East, but I think this is kind of the expected Middle East area. One of the most populous regions in the whole world. If you look at the population by country, you'll see that out of 233 million people, you've got about a little over 7 million in Israel. And you can see all the way from Egypt, which is some almost 82 million people now, and Iran next with 65 million. You can see Egypt and Iran are pretty powerful presences there. And especially that's why we can't dismiss Iran, as crazy as it is and as crazy as Mahmoud Ahmadinejad is. You can't dismiss it because it, just the sheer population size. But notice Israel, very small compared to most, second smallest next to Lebanon. Now, I've included in this chart the land that they evacuated in 2005 because I feel strongly they're going to get that back. They should not have given it away, and I think it will come back to them. But let's go back for a moment when the nation was founded. We talk about past conflicts or present conflicts. In 1948, remember, there were Arab refugees there. Now, they weren't forced to leave, but they were encouraged to leave by the Arab leaders because they said, look, once Israel settles in here, we're going to blow them away. You can come back. you know, and the land will be back to yours. So they left voluntarily. That's something I don't hear about. Okay. 68% of them left. They never even saw a soldier, an Israeli soldier. Now, the Jewish refugees, and there's a very good film out. It's called The Forgotten Refugees. Some of you may have seen it. Brother Ken Rawson shows it before showing on Israel in prophecy. But you can get that film from Vision Video. And if you haven't seen it, it's well worth it. It talks about the interviews of the Jewish refugees that had to flee the Arab lands because they were brutalized or persecutions. There were the pogroms, which are the organized kinds of eradication. And it's estimated, however, that if you took the land holding that those Jewish people had that fled the Arab lands, and that would be equal to or greater than what the area of Israel is today. So why are people complaining, saying that they don't have the land? It's not about land. The number of refugees, little uncertain on the number, but somewhere around 630,000 left Israel in 48, and almost the exact number of Jews came into the lands from Arabs. So you really just exchange populations. So it's not, again, about the fact of people wanting to get the land back and all the things you hear today in the conflicts about land. It's really not about that. But it was the War of Independence that really established the presence of Israel there today as we talk about Israel present. The Jewish community, as I said, a little over 600,000 people. There were a lot of people there that were survivors of the Holocaust that came in. But think about it. Now, you think about modern warfare, but think then, 1948, they had three tanks, they didn't have any planes, they had no bombers, and they were up against 74 fighter planes and bombers. 1% of the population was killed. Now, if you think about that, you know, it's like 3 million people being killed here. The revisionists have tried to erase that, say, well, it wasn't any big thing. They scooted out of the land. But if you read the history, when they opened that Burma Road to Jerusalem and pushed those tanks back, the Egyptian tanks that were moving up from the south were pushed back. The Syrian army coming down from the north was pushed back with a small population. It tells you that there was more than just their hand in this, that this was truly God coming back to say, I'm going to reestablish this nation. Well, we know it's happened recently. In August of 2005, things changed in Israel. Israel handed over all the Gaza, part of the West Bank, to the Palestinians. And, you know, it's really the first country that we've seen in modern history that ever gave up its land that was acquired in a defensive war. Now, some would say, well, it wasn't a defensive war, but I think it was. They were attacked by six armies. They gave up that land that they acquired because they were attacked that was granted to them. We ask the question, was Israel's abandonment of the land God's will? Now, if we took a poll, you might raise your hand. I'd say almost everybody would say no, because we know what the promise was. This promise in Exodus 23 that God gave to Moses, I'll fix your boundary from the Red Sea to the Sea of the Philistines, from the wilderness to the River Euphrates. The other highlighted part, this is the important part. He said, about the people that are in the land, you shall make no covenant with them or with their gods. They shall not live in your land. As long as they cooperate, I think God is not happy. They are going to have constant conflict as long as they have given this land up. Well, of course, we know what has happened recently. Operation Cast Lead happened last January. Remember, the Hamas was constantly bombing and smuggling from the border towns along Egypt. Israel struck in January. They shut down those smuggling operations. A number of caves that were used for smuggling were hopefully destroyed. Now, they're in the process of rebuilding a lot of those caves, but they were shut down, and, of course, Israel suffered a great deal of international criticism over it. In March, the United Nations Human Rights Council leveled this long list of accusations saying, here's what all the things you did in Gaza during Operation Cast Lead. Now, a lot of those were 11-year-old kids that were supposedly bombed and everything, but, you know, I think, unfortunately, again, it's like the deniers of the Holocaust. There was a lot of misinformation put out there, and I'll come back to that in a little while. But I think in all this, what we see, Israel today is at a crossroads. A lot of things are different than they were a decade ago. I want to take a brief look at what's happened in the last decade with those surrounding lands, most of them Arab, but what's happened with them in the last decade to change the Middle East, to create an entirely different scenario that, again, gives me evidence that God is moving forward with this plan and that this is the most visible sign we have that things are moving forward. We've seen a balance of power in the Middle East shift greatly. We've seen a lot of strategic alliances changed. And Israel, today what's going on just reflects this broader transition, I think, that's going on in the Middle East. As we think about prophecy and what happens, we certainly can see a transformation taking place. And let's look briefly at that. And the question becomes, what comes out of the new U.S. administration and the activities they will bring to the party? Of course, Psalm 83 is the most popular psalm we have connected with the conflict of Israel. I do believe Psalm 83 is a picture of the conflict that takes place from the time Israel's a nation up until the time of the end. And this, the part I want to focus on is really verse 4 and 5 because it's really the part that affects more today the sentiment that's out there. Psalm 83, 4 says, "They have said, come, and let us wipe them out as a nation, that the name of Israel be remembered no more." Well, that's really a summary of what we see today going on around them. That's the sentiment that's out there. Let's wipe them out from being a nation, and no one will compromise. Now, God has given a promise to Israel, and I think this is a promise that they can claim today, and one I think applies today, and it's Numbers 10:9. God says, when you go to war in your land against the enemy who oppresses you, then you shall sound an alarm with the trumpets, and you will be remembered before the Lord your God, and you will be saved from your enemies. Now, that was something he gave early on to Israel, but I think it's still appropriate today. God says that he will preserve them in that land whenever there's a war against them. And it's an important part, and as I said, I think that what's going on today is just the same as the conflicts they've had. The weapons are different, but people are still trying to wipe them away. Let's take a look at some of these areas around. Of course, Jordan is big in the news. King Hussein of Jordan had ruled since 1952, soon after Israel was established, died in 1999, succeeded by his son, Abdullah II, trying to recover some of the glory of Jordan, but not very successful. And Michael Suleiman, assumed office in May 2008. He was the former commander of the armed forces in Lebanon. Great conflict with Syria. Now, Lebanon and Syria are at odds all the time. When all the things were going on with Israel's war in Lebanon, there remained a constant issue around what would happen between Syria and Lebanon. And, of course, in Syria, we have Hafez Assad. He was a three-decade ruler, and remember, he died in 2000, and it was his son, Bashar, that took over. And, of course, Bashar is trying to get up to date. He's trying to modernize that country of Syria, and his father was really iron-fisted, controlled Syria. You know, Syria was a real problem area. Now, he does have the same authoritarian ideas, and, of course, he was forced soon after he took office to withdraw his troops from Lebanon. You know, he's never been convicted, but he's personally been implicated in the slaying of the former Lebanon leader, Rafik Hariri. And of course, then, everyone's friend, Saddam Hussein, 20 years in power, driven out in 2003 by the U.S. invasion. And now we have Nouri Kamal al-Maliki, the prime minister since May 2006, also, though still struggling to come into power. Here's the dynamic duo. George Bush and Saddam Hussein. Now, many people didn't like George Bush. I'm not here to present a political viewpoint. I think nobody likes Saddam Hussein. That's probably a safe one. But no matter what you think, consider this. Saddam Hussein was the only known sponsor of terror, the only open sponsor of terror. He openly funded the Palestinian efforts. He contributed $30 to $35 million to the families of those genocide bombers that were in Israel. Now, all those funds were channeled up through the Arab Liberation Front, and the last payment is documented in April 2003, just 2 months before the U.S. assault. He was the only Arab leader that would openly, morally, and financially support the Palestinian movement. Now, Israeli strategists had always talked about the fear, as we talked about with Jordan, that Jordan would be swallowed up by Iraq. Iraq would come in, swallow them up, and they would join with the Palestinians and attack Israel on this eastern front. Now that Hussein is gone, there is a peace treaty with Jordan, and it does relieve that threat. So no matter what you say, George Bush, I think, did God's will in wiping out that threat, and it's something to consider. Well, let's go back to Egypt. Hosni Mubarak of Egypt is a good example of some of a big change that I think is still happening. He's ruled since 1981. Now, he said that we're going to have free elections. In 2007, he said, anybody that wants to run against me can. But believe me, if you were running against him, your life was not too easy. And no surprise, he won by a landslide. His opponents were harassed. His supporters dispersed. 20% of the parliament there is now part of this Muslim Brotherhood. Now, he has a current conflict. Netanyahu's minister, Lieberman, made a remark that, well, he could go you know where if he didn't want to visit Israel. So it's very constant conflict. Now, recently there's been another big conflict. Just this last week, May 13th, in Cairo, Sheikh Ahmed Ali Othman, who's supervisor of the Dawah, which is the Islamic indoctrination of the Egyptian Waqf, that's the holy places, they rule the holy places, he issued this thing called a fatwa. And, you know, fatwa is a religious ruling, much like the Pope issues an encyclical. And he said in that fatwa, this is a religious statement, that the pigs in our time have their origins in the Jews who angered Allah, such that he turned them into monkeys, pigs, and Satan worshipers. So it's obligatory to kill and slaughter them, the pigs. Now, isn't that an intelligent statement for a religious ruler? But it shows you the hate that exists. You think there's ever going to be a peace made with them? King Fahd, Saudi Arabia. 23-year reign. He died in 2005. Today, his half-brother Aziz became king. And then we go to Israel. Israel, of course, Ariel Sharon was for many years in there. He was the last leader to have helped the creation of the Jewish state. That's pretty significant. Up to that time, they had all been involved in this conflict. And so he was really the last leader that was defined by this Israeli-Arab conflict. But, of course, 2006, he suffered this stroke, replaced by Ehud Olmert. And then in February of this year, Benjamin Netanyahu, who had been a former prime minister, was elected. Now, Netanyahu, we know, doesn't support the idea of a Palestinian state. And he's called this whole U.S.-backed peace talks a waste of time. He's refused to commit to the same two-state solution that all the other Israeli leaders did. Now, it's true his government is a supporter, but he said he's willing to discuss the peace, but they must have recognition and security. You know, it's interesting, isn't it? All they have to do, yes, Israel, you are there. We grant your security, but that's the hate that exists. So that whole generational shift, that whirlwind tour through the Middle East changes since the war, 1948, now has changed, raises this key question. You got lesser authoritarian governments, you got a new U.S. regime, you got fewer people from the outside dominating the situation, more stability, more tension. I'd wager on more tension. Israel's reputation was severely damaged in this 35-day war they had with Hezbollah in Lebanon. They kind of lost that aura of invincibility. People now said, hey, they can be beaten. It was the first time in 60-year history of the nation that they failed to defeat an Arab army. And, of course, then they earned this worldwide reproach, and I showed you the statement from the United Nations for bombing against these Lebanon civilians. But you know what wasn't reported? Important fact. And you can document this. Israel has made this public. Israel aborted 85% to 90%. Think about that. 85 to 90% of their airstrikes were aborted because the risk to civilians. Nobody talks about that. Well, then we move to Iran. Iran, of course, Mahmoud Ahmadinejad says he wants to finish what Hitler didn't do. That's to wipe the Jewish people off the map. Iran has a very powerful army at this point. And, of course, we know there's a lot of pressure on them around their weapons. But without a U.S. presence there, as there is today, the Iranian army would be the strongest regional military force. I showed you that chart because of the sheer numbers they have. Now, according to the Saudi paper, Al-Watan, Iran's Revolutionary Guards are now, today, deploying mobile launchers for surface-to-air and surface-to-sea missiles today in the Straits of Hormuz and even other areas surrounding the Gulf. Now, remember, the Gulf countries, because of their dynamic control over the world's oil and gas reserves, play a very key role and a very sensitive role to have anyone really trying to do anything militarily there. So I think the power is continuing, and I think it may happen that Israel will deal with this situation despite all the tough decisions that are going on now. So let's summarize by saying here's all the known terrorist organizations that exist today, all the ones we can sort of categorize and say here they are, and where their location are, the facts. There's one thing that unites every one of these terrorist groups. Okay, no great surprise. Destruction of Israel. Every one of them wants the destruction of Israel. Well, let's turn for a moment to Israel's past. You know, this conflict started long ago when Ishmael, of course, left and went to Paran, and all his descendants went in to become part of the desert people. And remember when Moses was crossing, the children of Israel were crossing the desert to get to the promised land, Numbers 20 records that conflict. Moses brings the people out of Israel, and it had all the land, the occupants are listed there, all the Canaanites, and the list of them. And God said, I don't want you to disturb them, okay? I want you to just pass safely through the land. So Moses sends messengers, and he sends messengers to the king of Edom. He says, look, we've got a common ancestry. We're going to go through your land, and we'll be, all we're going to do is pass through, and then we'll go to the other side, and it'll be over. Of course, they had somewhere as much as 2 to 3 million people. So that's a lot of people to pass through your land, but he was very reassuring. Well, they refused him safe passage, and after that became a perpetual nuisance to them. Moses eventually had to deal with them in a battle. Let's jump forward. Of course, all the apostles we know in our Newer Testament, all those apostles were Jewish except for Luke. But the early church, we have evidence, worshipped on the Sabbath to start. They celebrated the feasts. They attended the synagogue. At least in Rome, we have evidence of that. And you don't even find any non-Jewish names in the Jerusalem church until 135 A.D., before that first revolt in 66 A.D., Christianity, to a great degree, was viewed as kind of a sect of Judaism. But it was Claudius that then, when he came in, he banished the Jewish community from Rome. A lot of problems started when they finally came back. When they left, it was filled up by the Greeks coming out of Alexandria and saying, all the schools are closing there. We're going to come and take over this area, and we're going to get involved in the church. When the Jews returned, there was great social tensions. The Jews living in the presence of Gentile Christianity that really didn't want anything to do with them. And we see great conflict starting at that point. when Rome destroys the temple at Jerusalem, it's no longer the center of worship. Remember, Jerusalem had always been kind of that anchor position for even the early church. And then the rapid acceptance of Christianity amongst the Gentiles. And after the apostles died, including Paul, many of that was misdirected. But post 70 AD, after we had the temple destroyed, many of the Jewish sages started adopting Ben Hillel school of rabbinical practice, which was a scrupulous observance of the Torah and a total separation from anything to do with Christianity. So you see, the conflict began again. And then we had the development soon into the second century of replacement theology. The Jews no longer had any of the promises of God. They don't even have the scriptures. They're ours, Christians now. And this started with Justin Martyr in 160 AD. Irenaeus, who was called the Bishop of Lyon, 177 AD, said, "The Jews are disinherited from the grace of God." Tertullian, one of the greatest libraries of the early church, lived between 160 and 230 AD, said, "God has rejected the Jews in favor of Christians, didn't consider any promises for them." And of course, then we know Constantine becomes the first Christian emperor. 306 AD declares Christianity is now the official religion of the empire. Now, he'd previously given the Jews that same religious rites as Christians, and that started disappearing. The persecutions then began greatly in earnest. In 305 AD, we had the council in Elvira, Spain. It said Christians can't share meals with Jews. Christians can't marry Jews. Christians can't observe the Jewish Sabbath. The Edict of Milan in 313 outlaws all the synagogues. 321 AD, that's when business started to cease on Sunday. They substituted Sunday for what had been in many places the Saturday worship. And 4 years later, Sunday becomes proclamation by the state, the official day of rest. And then Eusebius, looked upon as one of the great fathers of history, a bishop of Vercelli in 370 AD, he says, the promises of the Hebrew scriptures no longer apply. They are transferred to the Christians. The church is a continuation, not an addition, but it's the continuation of the Old Testament. It supersedes Judaism, and Judaism is gone. The true Israel, Israel according to the Spirit. Those terms started being abused. And they say, God cast away the Jews. All his love is now on the Christians. But probably the one that started a great deal of difficulty, John Chrysostom, who was in Antioch in 387, wrote a number of sermons. He called them Eight Sermons Against the Jews. And this is what he said. The synagogue is not only a brothel and a theater, it's a den of robbers, a lodging for wild beasts. No Jew adores God. Jews are inveterate murderers possessed by the devil. Their debauchery and drunkenness gives them the manners of a pig. Notice the recurrent theme today, isn't it? Jews are abandoned by God. And note here, for the crime of deicide, there is no expiation possible. That Latin word, deicide, means God killer. Of course, it's the first time we saw this association with Jewish people, God killers or Christ killers. And they based it on Matthew 27:25. When they cried out, people cried out for Jesus' crucifixion, said, "Let his blood be upon us and our children." But, you know, think about it logically. How can you blame collective responsibility for all generations? Why don't we say that all Italians today are guilty of crucifying Jesus? Jesus willingly gave himself, John says. But the anti-Semitism then grew in the church. All the privileges that were there to the Jews were withdrawn. The jurisdiction that the rabbis had over the faith was removed. Proselytism was prohibited, punishable by death. The Jews were excluded from any high office, military service. The writings of the church leaders changed to very aggressive anti-Jewish sentiments. And the Jews became what in Latin was known as the servi camerae, the serfs of the chamber. Now, what did that mean? It meant that they were slave librarians. They were to maintain the Hebrew writings because it was a difficult thing because they needed to have those. They were the early records of the church. But they were also then shifted to be utilized for what was called usury, money lending. There was a growing economy emerging, and usury was considered, money lending was considered endangering to your Christian salvation. So what did they do? They gave that to the Jewish, to Jews. And the church endorsed this practice then of lending by the Jews because, hey, the Jewish souls are lost. They're going anyways. So we'll do that. Well, that's why if you think about today, you know, there's questions even raised today, and there's great conspiracy theories about Jews controlling all the commerce in the world. It's no different than it was then. The Western countries finally made them trade agents in commerce. It was a natural outgrowth of where they had been assigned. And that's why you see today so many Jewish people in banking and commerce, because that was the history. If you were a carpenter, or your father was a carpenter, you grow up in that trade too. The persecutions went on through the Crusades. In Germany, 1,300 Jews were taken to the palace and slaughtered. In Jerusalem in 1099, they put the Jews out of the synagogues. They went into the synagogues and burned them alive in there. 9 Crusades, 200 years. Spanish Inquisition, 350,000 Jews punished. And then we come to Martin Luther, and I know that we believe, and I think Martin Luther had a special role in the church. But he condemned the persecution of Jews at first. He recommended tolerance. In fact, he even wrote in 1523 this book that Christ was born a Jew. They were right to reject the papacy, but he said, hey, you know what? They should accept Lutheranism. And so he issues this 1530s, this table talk series that says they're not accepting Lutheranism. The stiff-necked Jews, they're iron-hearted, they're stubborn as the devil. And finally, in the 1540s, he writes a book called On the Jews and Their Lies. You know, that was the very book that Hitler used to justify with his own people the treatment that he put upon the Jews. And that history, unfortunately, led to the whole thing we have today of replacement theology, that Israel has no blessings. They're replaced by the church. They're no longer any kind of a chosen people, no different than anyone else. They have no independent future. Since Acts 2, Israel refers to the church, and the promises, the covenants, all the blessings have been taken away from them and given to the church. And really, the important thing is the translators from 1611 on held that view. It's very important as we look at translations and read our scriptures to remember that that's the attitude many of those translators had. But what does God say? In Amos 9, 14 and 15, he says, I will restore the captivity of my people. They will rebuild the ruined cities and live in them. They will also plant vineyards and drink their wine and make gardens and eat their fruit. I will also plant them on their land, and they will not again be rooted out from their land, which I have given them, says the Lord your God. Ezekiel 36, 24 to 28 says, I will take you from the nations, gather you from all the lands, and bring you into your own land. I will sprinkle clean water on you. Moreover, I will give you a new heart and put a new spirit within you. Isaiah 11, 11 and 12 says, God's covenant people would return to Israel. Notice what he says here. On that day, the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand, the remnant of his people. God said he would bring them back again. Brethren, in 2006, Israel reached a milestone. If nothing else, this is an important key fact in understanding that this is God's sign that he is favoring those people and bringing them back. After the Holocaust, there were only two centers of Jewish life, two main centers, America and Israel. You go back to 1990, the Jewish population in the U.S. was 5.5 million. In 2000, it was 5.2 million. Israel's Jewish population passed 5.6 million in the March quarter of 2006. Now, note this. First time since 135 A.D., since 135 A.D., that there were more Jews in Israel than in any other country in the world. Is that a sign from God? I think definitely it is. Now, what could change as we look towards a little more towards the future? This may seem a little out of place, but it isn't. 1916 forward to volume 4, Brother Russell was commenting on his last comments around the nation and what was going on there. He said this in the forward. He said, the debts of the warring nation. And he commented specifically on the debts of the nation. And at the very end, he says, evidently the war, he was talking about World War I, will not stop from lack of men to shoot and be shot, but either from lack of food or from financial weakness. That it will be the latter is the author's opinion. Now, I think he's absolutely right. The financial weakness of the world is what could drive the support away from Israel. Consider this. One possible scenario is we look at the U.S. being one of the main anchors of the support for Israel. You know, we've gone through an awful lot of money being injected into our economy and around the world. If we go out 10 years from now, in 2018, you see this chart. 2018, the interest on the debt may overtake the spending that we have on all the programs, the non-defense programs that are budgeted by Congress annually. There's in this budget, there's a discretionary spending list of $703 billion 10 years out. The Congressional Budget Office is the one that does this, the CBO. They said the interest payments will be $734 billion in that year. And revenues should swell to $1.4 trillion over 2008 levels. Now, I think that's what really can cause, you know, when you don't have the money to support defense. These are all the non-defense programs. We've got an aging population. We've got entitlement programs. 10 years from now, it's going to be overwhelming just servicing the interest on that debt, let alone the payments itself. So that's one possible scenario, I think, as we look out into the future of what could change the support that we see from the Western nations behind Israel. The CBO says $1.2 trillion deficit we will have in 2019. Now think about it. The entitlement costs, that's the Social Security and Medicare and all the things that we're going to give, including the proposal for national health care, will surge by $1.3 trillion. Interest costs will go up $550 billion. Now, if those costs arise, this is a quote from the CBO, all sorts of programs are going to be squeezed. In 2019, that means that 20 cents of every dollar in tax revenue just goes to support the debt, the interest payments on the debt. Well, let's take a brief look at the future, and then I want to open it up for your comments and questions. I think there will be in the future, perhaps, I don't know how far in the future, an Israeli-Arab war or a war with their surrounding nations based on Isaiah 11:14. It says, they shall fly upon the shoulders of the Philistines toward the west, spoil them in the east together. They'll lay their hand upon Edom and Moab, and the children of Ammon shall obey them. I think that's a prophecy that, again, they will take back much of their land. Because God says, Jeremiah 31, he says, I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel, with the house of Judah. And I believe that new covenant is indeed made with Israel. It says, I will put my law within them and in their heart. You know, that was the law covenant that Israel was under. The problem was it was all intellectual. It wasn't in the heart. Notice the difference. God says, now the covenant I will make, those laws will be inside of them. Brethren, that's what we're trying to do now as we go in. We had no old law covenant, but God changes our heart. That's the difference with the new covenant that God makes with Israel. It's no longer just a set of rules, but now it's an action that's spurred from the inside out. But he says, I will be their God, and they shall be my people. That's a promise to natural Israel. So what do we have left? I think the day of full restoration is Israel's near. What should we be doing? I think we should be encouraging our Jewish friends to make aliyah to Israel. It's time when the land is theirs. Israel will receive that new covenant. And Israel's land, despite everything we see around, is theirs forever. Our commission, I think at this time, Psalm 122, 6-9 says, pray for the peace of Jerusalem. They shall prosper that love thee. Peace be within thy walls, prosperity within thy palaces. For my brethren and my companions' sake, I will now say, peace be within thee. Because of the house of the Lord our God, I will seek thy good. Amen. Well, brethren, it's time. I'm sure it's spurred a lot of thoughts in your head. We're going to have some roving mics. And so it's time for you, if you have a question or you want to say, boy, Len, I think you're really all screwed up on that point, feel free to do so. Got one question back here, Tom. Brother Joe.
You pointed out that for the first time since 135, there are now more Jews living in Israel than in any other country. And you said we should encourage our Jewish friends to make Aliyah or return to Israel. Do you expect to see significant numbers of Jews returning from the United States, from Western Europe to Israel? And if so, what might be the impetus that would cause them to return to Israel?
I think the one big area that we haven't seen big migration from to Israel, back to emigration from, is the Western nation, especially the U.S. We haven't really seen a lot. We still have a fair number. And so I think there will be another mass immigration, and I think it's coming from the U.S. Now, what could drive that? Remember what I said, where a lot of the Jewish people work. Commerce, banking, financial markets. I've been dealing with financial markets for the last 30 years. And most of my friends in those financial markets are Jewish. I think if we go through an extended period of a financial crisis, jobs are being lost. I think Israel will prosper. Now, they're having a difficult time in their economy right now, but I think longer term they prosper. The attraction to bring that kind of brain power back to Israel to manage the economy there and to be a center of commerce, I think will be greatly attractive. And I think, if anything, that could bring a lot of those people back. I think it would be from the West, and I think it would be economically driven. That's why I think this crisis that we have now, we'll see improvement. But, it's not going to be like it was 20 years ago. And I think the opportunities to sort of do what's been done the last 30 years, where we had this debt-driven economy, is no longer going to be there. And I think it's going to make a lot of people rethink their values, and I think hopefully some of those Jewish people will decide that the time is right to go back to Israel, and I think that will be encouraged. So my belief is that the Western nations, it's the economic conditions that will drive many of the Jewish and attract them back to the land of Israel. Hey, over here, Jack.
How do you read Pope Benedict's recent visit to Israel?
Well, I don't know. What did he actually say? He didn't really give us much of a hint as to what his program was. Did anybody read anything or hear anything about his program that could shed some light on that? Bob, did you? Wait for the mic, yeah.
He made a pact back with Arafat. I mean, not him, John
right.
Paul. And I don't think this Benedict is any different. Benedict has his own issues with Islam. He's been very clear about that. But he's treading very gently in certain places. The Catholic Church has not taken a stand against Islam beating up on Catholics, which is very strange. And he's not the Catholic Church definitely wants Jerusalem. There's no question in my mind. They wanted it to be theirs when Israel was first formed. I think the pact was that they would have the rights to the holy sites. I think he wants that. And he's playing very, very cozy with them because he would like to have that control. So everything he said is in the level of... in fact, when they made the pact with Arafat over they would have control of holy sites if Arafat had control of the city, Israel wasn't even mentioned. It's a front page of a Jerusalem Post article, which I have a slide of. My own expectations are that somewhere down the line, he and or Krill from Russia will have a lot of influence in what's going to be happening with church involvement in controlling the holy sites of the old city. And if this appeal by the PA, the Palestinian Authority, has just said, we're willing to give up our claims to the Temple Mount, if you turn that over to this organization of, right. I think, 51 Islamic states, that would mean that Iran would have a piece of the action on controlling the Temple Mount, which is horrific, of course. But that's the direction they seem to be going. By the way, it was Jerusalem Day 2 days ago. We celebrate it by going to a Jewish bookstore and a Jewish restaurant.
Good, thank you. Okay.
Well, he, at Yad Vashem, he did not apologize for the Holocaust. And when he went into the, I don't remember the city, but it was in Jordan, he was at the wall, the separating wall, and said what a misfortune it was that they would have that wall because of how many would be killed. And also that he didn't recognize that the wall was put there because so many Jews had been killed. And he was also made statements in favor of a two-state solution, which really bothered the Jewish people.
Thanks. Yeah, I think a couple of things that were mentioned there. I think Russia especially seems to be going to play a bigger role. Bob, you got some follow-up? Yeah.
I just lost it, Len. I'm sorry.
It's all right. I do that all the time.
It has to do with his... I'll pass.
So I think Russia certainly is emerging, re-emerging as a power, and I think they are very much aligning themselves with the Russian Orthodox Church, and I think he knows where the control is, and I think you're going to see Russia play a bigger role, and I think many brethren believe that Russia is a major force, of course, in Ezekiel 38. And I think the Arab nations do. Arabia plays a role in that, too, and I think we're going to see more and more power kind of shifting in the Middle East. I think one of the long-term trends that we see going on today and what's brought about by the current economic crisis is a shifting of power from the East to the West and the Southern Hemisphere. Now, don't discount the Southern Hemisphere. The Catholic Church is well and alive in the Southern Hemisphere. At some point, I do believe there's going to be a pope come from Africa. And I think that 40% of the new converts in the Catholic Church are coming from Africa. It's a very different kind of scenario. But, you know, again, is highly Islamic. And I think we see this constant conflict between Islam and Israel that's going to emerge and play a big role in the Middle East as we go on. Hey, maybe we got time for maybe one more. Yes, Molly. Right there.
You mentioned about these wealthy people like Sadoff and those. Could it be that we would have a great anti-Semitism movement that could happen like in the days of Hitler come into this country?
Well, I don't think we have to wait. I think it's already there. There's a lot of talk around. Of course, it's very subtle now, but conspiracy theories abound. And, you know, you get a few things happen, you know, like that. You know, you can get that. I think the United States is a unique role because anti-Semitism, open anti-Semitism that's tolerated, is not as easy here as it would be someplace like England where you got one-third of the population that's Muslim and you do see laws starting to accommodate, you know, change things. So I don't think you necessarily see government persecution, but I think there certainly could be pogroms and things like that that could emerge. And again, as part of the role in driving, making it much more attractive for Jews to live in Israel than in other parts of the world. Brethren, I hope it's been helpful for you. Give a few things to think about. Appreciate your comments. I know it's something we all look for because it is one of the great signs of the Lord's presence and that God is again carrying out his plan. And those beautiful promises we heard about all day are something we should rejoice in because it means, as this says, as the theme says, now our salvation is nearer than it was before.